We are a country that our media are covering and focused on what's wrong and who's attacking who, and that's what's getting emphasis, that's what's getting analysis. And so that's our steady diet, right? That's what we consume. And the consumption of that has implications, because then we really start to believe that they're really out to get us, they're really bad people. And so it's not just that the media is choosing that, it's reflecting it and it shapes us.
Welcome to Making Peace Visible, the podcast about peace, conflict, and the media. I'm your host, Jamil Simon. The goal of peace building as a practice is to help opposing groups work out their differences constructively and without violence. As we've covered on this show, peace building isn't just a process of negotiations between governments and paramilitaries. It happens when a family of victims can forgive a former militant who killed their child in a civil war, or when Palestinians and Israelis work across cultures to bring clean water to remote communities. It happens in workshops where Indians and Pakistanis meet each other face to face for the first time. In the last decade, the field of peacebuilding has turned its eye towards the United States as polarization has gotten worse and political violence has increased. My guest, Peter T. Coleman, is part of that movement to bring peacebuilding or bridge-building practices to Americans. Peter Coleman is a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University and a renowned expert on conflict resolution and sustainable peace. He first joined us almost 3 years ago to discuss his book, The Way Out, How to Overcome Toxic Polarization. And Peter returns to the podcast with some sobering news. Depolarization efforts haven't been very successful in the United States. That's according to an analysis of 77 interventions aimed at decreasing partisan animosity, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It shows that while interventions can briefly reduce animosity, their effects are small and short-lived. But Peter's not giving up. He's just changing tactics. I'm excited to talk to Peter about his most recent research, which he says is part of a radical new science of peace. In this latest study, Peter's lab used AI to comb through news reports from a diverse group of 18 countries, including the United States. What they found points to a new way to understand what makes a society more peaceful or more polarized. Peter, welcome back to Making Peace Visible. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, sure. It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for the invitation.
So I want to start by spending a few minutes catching up on the issue of polarization in America, which was the focus of our first conversation in December 2022. A lot has changed since the last time we talked.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Things are worse.
Yeah, much worse. I mean, in your writings, you're one of a chorus of political thinkers calling for resistance to autocracy. But how do you fight autocracy on one hand and build bridges with people across political divide at the same time? That almost sounds like an either-or proposition.
Well, I'm a big fan of the definition of first-rate intelligence as the capacity to hold two seemingly contradictory thoughts in your head at the same time and still function. And I think that's what this requires. It requires a time to have tolerance and acceptance for people who politically are different from you, and to mobilize when necessary, when possible, in nonviolent ways to put pressure on the system to correct away from autocracy and back into democracy. So it really requires being able to hold on to both of those ideals and still function.
One of the things that I appreciate about you and your work is that you have a message for just about everyone. When we last had you on the show, you encouraged our listeners to do something called the Polarization Detox Challenge. You know, and it's a series of brief exercises that you do once a day for 4 weeks, meant to help people shift their thinking and connect with people they disagree with. I think it's been about 2 years since you launched that challenge with the Builders Movement, which was then called Starts With Us, and it's still available online if people want to try it. What have you learned from people's experience with that challenge?
Well, I think the response was, you know, pleasantly good, but not great. I think there's a combination of things happening today. Certainly, as you know, our kind of slide into autocracy and the fears and the anxiety that that is raising sort of deadens people's willingness or interest in bridge building, right? It's really like it feels like it's a time to fight, not a time to talk. So the motivation to engage across these differences is decreased. You know, and part of that is the deep, profound loss of power of the progressives, you know, in all of our government, in the Supreme Court, at the state level. There really is this sense of helplessness and powerlessness. And so it's really hard to imagine bridge building when you're at, you know, such a disadvantage.
And such an incredible divide. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, and an increasingly deep divide. I mean, I do think that the good news is that, you know, the middle is still exhausted and fed up and wants something else. And so there is a seed of hope in that there's enough people that are miserable with the current state of our society in this country. And this, by the way, is not just in this country. It's in many Western-style democracies across the world. But the other thing that I think we've learned, which is a little disheartening, but I think important, is that the bridge building field, which I'm part of, is not really terribly effective. There was a paper that came out in what's called PNAS, which is the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, by some scholars, and they had done what they call a meta-analysis, where they look at a bunch of different studies and they look at the impact of things like, you know, training and bridge building and encounters that bring people together. And basically, the overwhelming finding is that it doesn't really move the needle. That these effects of these kinds of encounters are small, they're temporary, they only last a weekish, maybe 2 weeks if you're lucky, and they don't scale. They haven't really, you know, they're reaching a very small part of the population and not oftentimes the people that you need to reach. So it's very blue, it's very progressive, the audiences that participate, and it's still, the numbers are very small. And even in these bigger groups like Braver Angels, which get a lot of attention and media, and I don't want to disparage that. I think it's really important and well-intentioned, but I just don't think it's going to work, right? And so what these authors say, and what I agree on more and more, and I try to write about this in The Way Out. By the way, there's a second edition of The Way Out that will come out next fall before the election, before the midterm election.
Oh, great.
Where it kind of updates just some of the current science. But what I stress is that, you know, this is something that is a macro problem. It's not just me or you and me and how we talk to each other. That's certainly part of it. But it's a bigger problem. And it really does require us thinking not about individual change or psychological change, but really about social structures, social movements. And so, you know, again, that's what the evidence says. And more what I've been trying to share, for example, in the new preface of The New Way Out, this is an idea about change that comes from Robert Putnam and others, but...
Yeah, the author of Bowling Alone, yeah.
Right. And what Putnam says is, you know, what you need to do is not have like bridge building events, but you need to basically go to where people are connecting across their differences for whatever reason. And then in those spaces, bring people together and maybe pair people in ways that are more intentional. And a group that's done this over the past couple of years, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, brought together all of the major service organizations in this country, you know, Mercy Corps, the Y, Habitat for Humanity. And what's true about America, and this is true from de Tocqueville, is that Americans do help their neighbors, and they're motivated to do that. 78 million Americans join formal organizations to do service work every year. And that doesn't count people that are just kind of helping in their neighborhood. 78 million Americans. And so what the Rockefeller brothers recognize is that's kind of an infrastructure where people come together across their differences to help. And they're motivated really just to help. They're not motivated about politics.
Yeah, they have a mission that's bigger than
that. Yeah. So they then asked me to come in, and a woman named Linda Tropp. You know, what we said to them was like, Habitat for Humanity, you're awesome and you're doing fantastic work and it's resonant with people. Don't mess it up with our advice. You know? But you might want to think about, in how you do what you do, who you put together and how you set it up and maybe how you debrief it afterwards. And, you know, there can be some kind of low-hanging things that are about intentionally bringing people together across political or religious or racial differences, you know, in the work that they're already doing. And there was a report that came out by this group called Convergence. David Eisner was one of the authors of it, but that after a couple of years really talked about the impact of that. That's the kind of thing that we need. It's really recognizing what people want to do anyway, and then going there and shaping the kind of norms or rules or taboos or whatever you want to call them when people come together.
That's very interesting.
Isn't it? Yeah, I think that's a really important shift in how we think about this, because it's, again, it's not just making people get along. And it's frankly, I don't think about getting people across difference together to talk to each other, because those are usually events. They're episodic. There are moments. That doesn't help today. It can help sometimes, not today. Today, we're in this sort of swirl of antagonism and enmity that is just coming at us from so many directions that we really need to go to places where people go a lot, and they go there because they want to for their own reasons, and that we start to shape the kind of norms and processes where they gather.
Yeah, no, it reminds me of a book by an Indian sociologist whose name I can't remember, but he wanted to find out why some cities in India had a lot of ethnic strife and others didn't. And he went to the ones that didn't have ethnic strife. And what he found was there was an ambiance or a culture that allowed people to work together on PTAs, on choirs, on Rotary clubs, Lions clubs, you know, and which underlines exactly what you just said, you know, that people are joined over a mission, over a shared desire to do something. It's a message that you wrote about in The Way Out, and one that you continue to talk about, is it's the importance of mixing, of interacting with people different from you ideologically, culturally, and in other ways. I mean, one of the key things about the radical new science of peace is that we all have a part to play in this. But what about our leaders? You know, do you see any hope there? I mean, there seems to be structural things that force them to be pushed apart.
I mean, I think that if we're talking about political leaders or pundits, you know, people that are our influencers, I think that system is pretty broken. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we are where we are. But what can happen out of these times is that new leaders emerge. I'm very interested to see how Mamdani will take up the role of mayor in New York City and whether he will be able to or interested in sort of uniting and bringing people together and being a functional mayor of the city, which is an impossible city to run. I wake up every morning and I'm think, how do they do this? You know? How do they pick up the garbage? I just don't understand how it's possible.
It is amazing. It is amazing.
I mean, there are people, I have to say, there's a friend of mine, a colleague of mine that gave me a document called the Third Founding Declaration. There are people who are really looking at our constitutional structures and our electoral structures and really saying these are old and flawed and don't work anymore and can be easily weaponized if you don't accept the norms. We have to take a hard look at those things that, again, incentivize certain kinds of leadership. Again, it's not necessarily the individual that comes up, but it's what is the system attracting and encouraging.
So now that we have the lay of the land, I want to talk about some of your new thinking and what you've learned from using AI large language models in your research. I mean, in a political sense, peace is usually only talked about in the context of resolving violent conflict. But you're arguing instead taking a proactive approach to peace, that is, including the promotion of peaceful values. Why this paradigm shift?
Well, this is something that I'm not alone in. There's a peace anthropologist named Doug Fry who has studied peaceful societies around the world and throughout history. And we actually did a study where we looked at some of these societies over time and compared them, sort of high peace societies and low and what we call non-peace societies or lower peace societies. And what we found is that what really differentiates them over time is that they have norms and taboos and rituals and values inherent to their societies that are pro-peace, that promote peace and that really are, you know, against violent problem solving. And that's very clear and it's very deep in these societies. And of everything that matters, leadership and, you know, everything, those norms really matter. Those norms, values, and rituals, you know, that's one of the things I think is interesting. These societies celebrate peace. They're thrilled and proud of being peaceful societies. Mauritius is one of those. I've studied Mauritius, and they are very proud of the fact that they've been able to sort of pivot their society from ethnic troubles to a really a pro-peace society. And so they ritualize that. And if you think of our country, if you go to the mall in Washington, D.C., you see remembrances and celebrations and honoring of war and warriors. And there really isn't a recognition of peacemakers. So it's not something that happens in our country.
It's invisible.
Unfortunately, it's terribly invisible. You know, what we recognize is that ultimately positive societies have a ratio. Sustainably peaceful societies have a ratio. And the ratio is that you have a lot of relations between members of different groups that are positive and kind and friendly and neighbors and, you know, supportive of each other. And there's conflict. Right. There are differences and there's, you know, grievances and things happen. And if you have enough positivity, this is from research in marriages and at the global level. If you have enough trust and rapport and respect for one another, when there is a conflict and there's a pain point, it's a problem to solve. And that enhances your capacity to live together going forward. And so it's really a balance of both, or what we call a ratio of both, where you have a preponderance of positivity and some negativity, which makes sense and is necessary and valuable, but only if it doesn't overwhelm the relationships, right? If negativity seeps in everywhere, like it has in our media and in our nation, then what you see is a toxic state that isn't sustainable.
Well, one thing you mentioned is the dual systems model of sustaining peace. Can you explain that?
Yeah, what's interesting is when you study nations at war, there's a woman named Gabrielle Bloom at Harvard, who's a law professor, who studied and found what she calls islands of agreement. And she would study Kashmir and Israel-Palestine and, you know, Northern Ireland at its time. And what you see in these places, what's obvious is that there's violence and war and enmity. But what you also often see are people that are working together, talking to each other, trying to work things out, trying to make a difference, trying to keep the conversation going. And those are what she would call islands of agreement, right? That even in war zones, those things are prevalent. And what she argues and what we find is that oftentimes peace emerges from those places. There's oftentimes a state of both positivity and negativity in any kind of relationship. Think about your siblings, you know? Like, I love my siblings. They're fantastic people, and they're some of the people that drive me crazy. I hold on to all of that, right? And ideally, there's a preponderance of friendliness and love and connection. And the irritants, you know, either you just ignore or you work through because you want a better relationship, right? And that scales up to societies. And it is that when there's conflict and differences, that you have enough connection and rapport and fun together and good memories that you can learn from conflict and, you know, make adjustments and change.
Peter, in research published earlier this year, your team used the news media as a tool to measure and compare peacefulness in countries around the world. Could you tell us about how that worked?
In the past 6 or 7 years, I've been working with teams of data scientists and AI to understand at the kind of global level things like the media and media's presentation. There's a thing called NOW, which is news on the web, and it has, you know, millions of articles. And you can identify articles that come from certain countries. And so we oftentimes will choose a range of countries that are considered more peaceful and less peaceful. And then we scrape the media and we see if there are differences there. And what we found is that there are profound differences in the language and in the portrayal of certain things, the focus on certain content in the media versus others. One of the more interesting things we found is this ratio of positivity to negativity. And we recently published a paper, and there's a piece I wrote in Psychology Today on this, which is, you know, for the general public. And it really just says that what you see across the world is that there are countries where the media really covers when members of different groups are working things out, and getting along and working together and celebrating each other. It's not just tolerating each other. It's like there are religious groups that actually participate in other religious, you know, rituals and festivals. And so there is this kind of engagement. And when the media emphasizes that, it does correlate with the relative peacefulness of those societies. We studied 18 different countries, Ireland, New Zealand, Canada, were in the 70, 80, 90% percentile. Singapore, also, a lot of representation of positive intergroup connections. But the U.S., Kenya, other places were terribly low. What this reflects is not necessarily that what the media is focused on, because that's part of it. But if you look at sort of Canada and the U.S., their media isn't dramatically different. It's somewhat different, but not dramatically different. But Canada had, I think, a 76% positive representation. The U.S. had a 2%. So we are a country that our media are covering and focused on what's wrong and who's attacking who. And that's what's getting emphasis. That's what's getting analysis. And so that's our steady diet, right? That's what we consume. And the consumption of that has implications, because then we really start to believe that they're really out to get us. They're really bad people. They're, you know. And so it's not just that the media is choosing that, it's reflecting it, and it shapes us, right? Because we consume media.
Talk a little bit about how this research was done. I mean, can you describe the parameters a bit and how you measured peace and what types of media were included?
Yeah, well, so I'll back up a little bit, because we've been doing this for several years. We've done different kinds of studies. It's all kind of what we call big data research and using AI, large language models, to help us with the analysis and the interpretation. To be candid with you, the rationale for it was that I and our team has been critical of the current peace indices, because there's the global peace index and the positive peace index and the, you know, happiness index and humanitarian. There are these indices that exist, and they're all flawed. They're flawed because they're filled with assumptions about what is a good and bad society, like a very strong pro-business orientation. But they're also based on data that is late. You know, that is data collected last year, and then it's processed, and then a report comes out. And so anyway, we've been critical of these indices for a long time. And at some point we thought, okay, it's easy to be a critic. It's harder to offer a real alternative. Maybe we should try to do that. So we started to partner with the Data Science Institute of Columbia. We took the top five peace indices, averaged the scores, and then we sorted countries into the highest peace and the lowest peace countries. And so we had like 18 different countries. And what we did is then scrape language from the media of these high peace and low peace countries. Fortunately, I was working with Larry Leibovich, who's a brilliant physicist. And he said, well, let's use machine learning and see if there are differences in the language. And so we just asked the computer, all right, look at the more extreme peaceful society media accounts and look at the more extreme, you know, non-peace societies, and are there differences? And it said, absolutely. So we were able to, from that study, glean what we call word clouds of terms that were frequent and important. So then we have some sense of what the difference is. So what we had to do then is we spent a year ago last summer, several months, having focus groups with journalists and peacemakers, peace builders, and poets and other kinds of language experts from these societies, right, from the societies that we were measuring, and said, what do you see here? Here are two word clouds. Why are these differences here? And they helped us interpret what was important in these differences. And it was from that that we identified these important distinctions. And one of them is this kind of ratio of positivity to negativity in the language, right? In the sentiment of the language. So that's how we got to this place in the first place.
Looking ahead, one interesting recommendation you offer is that societies should establish effective conflict resolution mechanisms long before disputes escalate. You know, how would these mechanisms differ from a, say, a just legal system?
Well, they complement a just legal system. So let's look at a country specific, Costa Rica. So Costa Rica, as you probably know, came out of a bloody civil war in 1948, terrible deaths, and one of the rebel leaders became president. And they said, as a society, we don't want to ever do this again. We really want to pivot and move in a different direction and invest less in the military and more in business and education and, you know, the economy, green economy. So they were at the forefront of that kind of pivoting.
And lo and behold, they became the most prosperous country in Central America.
One of the most peaceful and prosperous, certainly in the Western Hemisphere. But what was interesting is that if you talk to Costa Ricans, certainly policymakers, what they'll say is, you know, it took us 50 years, but we grew a new society. And we did that by ultimately mandating in all of the public schools conflict resolution, tolerance training, kind of respect for differences as a core component of the curriculum so that we would grow young people who could respect one another and work out their problems. So that was, again, having a more developmental view of how do you, from the bottom up, grow a new culture. And that, I think, is a hard thing to do because, again, you have to really think long term. And it's like, it's not necessarily changing the structures, but it is changing the values that are imparted in education and how that ultimately affects young people who grow up and run the country. So they believe that that was a fundamental way of introducing constructive conflict resolution mechanisms into the fabric of society by socializing children in new ways.
I mean, you know, I'm a big believer in universal service, but I think we should give people a choice in the way they want to serve. I mean, some prefer the military, others the Peace Corps, Teacher Corps, AmeriCorps, whatever. The key thing is that it's an intentional way of mixing young people across social, cultural, and economic and racial divides. I mean, in the late 60s, when I grew up, it was the draft that did the
mixing. Yeah, that's right. And the Peace Corps.
I mean, you'd meet a guy and you'd say, hi, how are you? What's your draft status? I mean, it was like the weather.
That's right.
But now we're separated more and more from each other by zip code, by tribe, and unfortunately by social media tools.
Yeah, too. Yeah. And we're more self-focused, right?
Yeah. So how can we change the institutions, you know?
Yeah. I mean, again, that's a value. I mean, who was it? Putnam's book, The Upswing. But there is a book that's come out recently about how we've, you know, went from in like the 1900s, the me generation or the I generation. And then we became, you know, more concerned with the we and this collective. And then after 1960, we went back to me. You know, it is what they call a social dilemma. Do you do things that are best for you, or do you do things best that are best for all of us, or some combination of both? And we're always navigating that space. But certainly currently with social media and a lot of, you know, the influencers and the politicians that we have out there that are kind of campaigning on selfishness, right, then you lose that motivation and that modeling of helping, you know, serve the greater good.
I mean, making peace visible is built around the idea that if we don't learn how peace is made, we inevitably default to more war. And because people don't see peace as a possibility, you know, that's a fundamental problem. And that seems to be what's happening in the U.S. and around the world with a lot of help from social media platforms and the new administration. And it's not just learning how peace is made, but it's also learning how to reduce conflict. You know, they're two different things. And the challenge is, like we talked about earlier, is it's doing it at scale. Can you talk about ways to make social cohesion a shared goal?
Well, again, I think it has to come in from different directions. As I said, I think young people is where we got to start. And that's with parenting and that with schools and, you know, and having the emphasis not on individual achievement, but really on working together and working things out. Developmentally, it has to start there. But it is also about, you know, what are the television shows? What are the, you know, what's being modeled in our society? Who are the influencers? And, it, you know, I mean, I don't know the world of influencers very well, but I don't imagine decency is the coin of the realm, you know?
Right.
I imagine it's the opposite, right? And that's certainly true in social media, is that what, you know, what outrages sells. It's a business model of both mainstream media and social media, and it's part of what drives our anxiety and our outrage and our, you know, intolerance of one another. And so that has to change. What I say to my students, because, you know, they're like, well, what's the government going to do about this? And my response is, well, the government's not going to do anything about this. In fact, they're fanning these flames. So the only group that can do anything about this is you. You all have to say to Facebook, I am out. I am done. Until you change, until you put up some guardrails, I am out of this. Because you're the consumers that are paying their bills. And if you mobilize, you have extraordinary power to affect change. Don't wait for the government to catch up. You have to do it.
Well, that happened in Vermont.
Yeah.
You know, they created a Facebook page for the state that is more popular than Facebook. It's called the Front Porch.
Oh, I do know. And, yeah, I know that. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And it's
local.
You know,
yeah.
It's moderated. Yeah. It's got rules. You know, there's no hate speech, no character assassination. And it works. And believe it or not, people love it.
But that's promising, right?
They don't have the algorithms. It's moderated. I mean,
yeah. And that's the, again, it's not rocket science how you need to do this. It's just something that Facebook and, you know, the major platforms have no interest in, right? Because they've known that they're contributing.
Their profit model is the opposite. You know, about 58% of our listeners are in the United States and another 42% are spread out around the world. What is one thing that someone listening can do in any country to help foster or sustain peace?
Well, I guess I would say a couple of things. I think there are kind of micro things that you can do, and then there are macro things that you can do. And I think some of the micro things are really just about you taking responsibility for you. And that might mean walking or meditating once a day, or trying to put yourself in a place where you have some perspective. We all get so busy and overwhelmed and then addicted to our media, and it's toxic, and it really does have an effect on us and how we show up and how we react to people, how overreactive we are. So I think, you know, to some degree, it does start with small things like that. But the other thing I would say that science, and I've talked about this in The Way Out, that science tells us to do is, if you do have others that you disagree with, you feel you're becoming estranged from, or you don't want to be, and you really are sort of stuck, take them for a walk. Go with them outside. You know, there's all kinds of research on the value of power of nature, but there's also research about the power of physical movement, and ideally physical movement together, outside, side by side, and having conversations. And I've done this, and I've written about this, having conversations with people that, you know, again, you may be increasingly estranged from or politically very different from, and sitting at a table and talking about it goes nowhere. So go outside and take a walk and, you know, again, breathe and prepare yourself to be a better listener.
That's critical.
Yeah. But we do also find that physically moving outside, side by side, having nature go past you as you walk together and not seeing each other as the problem, but recognizing that you're sort of part of this world, those simple things are, you know, give you a leg up on a difficult time.
Well, Peter, we could talk for a long time because there's a lot of...
Well, we'll talk again, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah.
But I really deeply appreciate your sharing some of your time and your insights with us.
My pleasure. As I said, let's keep the conversation going. And thank you for shining the light out there.
Peter is also a prolific essayist. You never have to wait a long time to know what he's thinking. We have links in the show notes to his Medium post on the research we discussed in the interview and to other articles. You can find more research at the website of the lab Peter directs at Columbia University's Teachers College, the Morton Deutsch International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. That link is in the show notes as well. If you got something out of this episode, please share it with a friend. An easy way to do that is to take a screenshot of your podcast player on your phone and send it via text with a note about why you recommend it. You can browse all of our past episodes at makingpeacevisible.org/podcast. Making Peace Visible is produced by Andrew Moraskin. The associate producer is Faith McClure, and I'm Jamil Simon. Thanks for listening, and talk soon.